As the people are affected by the program, so the program is affected by their changes in attitudes. A successful PSYOP program will make them perceive things from the desired viewpoint.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and I have a question for you. What does a universe, a salad, a kayak, and the Roman Forum all have in common? I'm not entirely sure either, but I've somehow managed to mention each of them in this episode's enjoyable conversation with Dr. Kathleen Carley. Dr. Carley is Professor of Computer Science, Engineering and Public Policy, as well as Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University, and the Director of the Center for Computational Analysis of Social and Organizational Systems. You might also know her as the developer of the Aura software for network analytics and visualization that you may have been using for social network analysis. As we will hear, social cybersecurity involves the use of computational social science techniques to understand and possibly counter social manipulations online. But the human is very much at the center of the approach, and as such, so too is the need for multidisciplinary research. As regular listeners know, I'm always very interested in these kinds of approaches. But first, I want to know, how does one start on their journey to being a computational social scientist?
Well, partly it was because I love to read. And when I was like in junior high, I read a book by Isaac Asimov, or a series of books called the Foundation Trilogy. And they talked about this person, Hari Seldon, who was able to predict social behavior, statistically, and using his computer models, I looked at it and said, that's what I want to do. And that, so from junior high on, that's all I wanted to do.
And more recently, you've sort of come to cybersecurity and online problems. I'm trying to steer away from deviance, but I guess I can say online deviance.
Yeah, so we actually call the area social cybersecurity because we're concerned with things like disinformation or hate speech or extremism online.
Is that just more recently or have you been looking into it for a while?
I've looked at this particular area basically since the start of Twitter and Facebook. But before that, I looked at some of the similar kinds of issues, but in things like email or just by looking at the diffusion and behavior among people just when they're talking in their offices.
Is there much difference between the two?
Quite a bit, actually. The thing is, when you're talking with people through social media, the technologies themselves influence the way you can talk and the kinds of things you do, right? Like you can put likes on things or you can just follow anyone you want. If you're just talking to them one-on-one, you only have so many seconds to go around talking to people. So you're limited physically, and you don't have this kind of constant popularity game going on.
It seems like quite a complicated problem. And besides people like yourself, what kinds of group are working on this, and are they working on it well together, do you think?
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. You need it to not just be interdisciplinary, but we like to say transdisciplinary, because we're finding that a lot of the theories and methods of individual disciplines aren't right in this space. So we need to kind of reinvent them and reinvent new theories. So there's people from just about every discipline you can imagine. There's people from cognitive science, there's people from brain science, there's people from policy, from legal studies, there's people from sociology, computer science, engineering. As far as I can tell, just about every single discipline has something to offer. But in addition, it's more than scientific disciplines. It's also people from different positions in our societies have different things to offer because they're seeing the issues from different perspectives and they can do different kinds of things. So you want legislators to be involved. You want, corporations involved and so on.
I always think about cyberspace as being sort of a universe. Like it's a space, and it, inside that universe is all of the things that exist in our universe, but it's on sort of a slightly different dimensional plane. But mm-hmm. when we go exploring in this new universe, it's kind of like when people were exploring new worlds a couple of hundred years ago. They would first send
explorers and then adventurers and then botanists and then physicists and so on and so on and so on. Do you think we're at that stage now with cyberspace where we should be bringing everybody?
Yes, I do think we should be bringing everybody. And it's interesting that you described it as kind of a universe, because often when we look at the actual data from social media platforms, it often looks like these little clusters of stars, right? And these stars that are more dense are clusters of people and topics together. So where our physical world is defined by rivers and oceans and so on, in the whole social cybersphere, social media sphere, it's defined by things like what ideas are trending and how you can physically move from one platform to another. Like, you can upload a YouTube video here.
We have this universe, and now we have a problem in it. And the problem is around these social network engines and social media engines.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the problem? So what is the problem with things like Twitter and things like Facebook?
People. No, and I'm not really being flip here. The platforms in and of themselves just provide a way for you to communicate and do certain things, right? But people have come up with all these ways of taking advantage of that to get their own objectives met, whether it's to sell some new kind of cosmetic or whether it's to go and push a particular political agenda, or even just to gather a group of like-minded souls who all want to believe that the earth is flat together. You know, it's being used in that way. But the technologies themselves, like the platforms like Twitter, each of them put different constraints on what you can and can't do. And the thing is, constraints are also enablers. They also let you do certain things. And people are very good at figuring out how to manipulate those constraints to get what they want.
I remember seeing advertisements on TV when the internet started. And one of the advertising points was you could find people on the internet who were interested in just the same thing as you were. I think it was making kayaks or something like that. If you were really into kayaks, then you could find your group of people who made kayaks. That was seen as a great benefit of the internet, but now only talking to your kayak friends could be a problem. Now you're getting siloed in with particular groups of people. Has anything changed?
The thing I think that's changed the most is that, yes, you can still go out and find whoever it is on certain things. And that's led to a lot of groups that are like self-help groups. But it's also led to all these new platforms where they could go and have their self-help group, but shut off those who were distracting, who were trolling them and trying to disrupt them. That's one thing. The other thing that's changed is that it's become easier to find groups who are engaged in whatever adversarial or bad thing you want to find. You can go and find that kind of group too. But those groups now are actively recruiting. And so people didn't think about the recruiting aspect as much at first. And then because there's so many, if the platforms respond and say, "Oh, we don't like what you're talking about, go away, you're no longer on this platform," fine, you go to the dark web. So having more platforms, active recruiting, and then also having the ability to self-police are some of the newer things.
I very occasionally watch the news, and the news tells me that the problem is bots, and we should just get rid of the bots.
The news doesn't quite understand bots. Well, bots are basically just tools, right? They're just an AI program that basically does what people tell it to do. So bots can be extremely valuable, or they can be completely harmless. For example, there was a bot that was called Big Ben that all it did was tweet out the time of day. But there's other bots that, like during natural disasters, they tell people where to go and where to get help. And, you know, and they're used in places like Indonesia and so on to actually get information out faster and can therefore save lives. So bots are just a tool. The problem is when you have people setting up bots to actually actively spread disinformation or to actively retweet hate speech. They can be a force multiplier. And when they do that for things that harm, you know, harm people, then it's not the bots, but it's people using become problematic.
If just finding bots is not going to tell us much about the problem. What should we look at? Should we start doing analysis of the text? Do we just look at the likes? Are they the same thing?
We found much better success by looking at not just the text, but also looking at who's actually interacting and talking to whom. Because one of the things we find is that, remember how we talked about how it was like a universe, there's all these like little groups that are talking together about the same topic? You can actually use the technology to form those groups, to convince them to talk in a certain way, you can raise certain people up as leaders. So you have to, but you do this by manipulating both the who's talking to whom, the social network part, as well as the who's talking about what, the narrative part.
Would the platform change the way that people are able to speak and therefore their ability to manipulate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as you take on Zoom, right? First, you know, there was very limited ways of interacting. Then there's the yes and no hand. Then there's the yes and no buttons. And as they add more features, they give people more ways of exchanging and getting involved in dialogue. So each of the different social media platforms, because they give people different things they can do, have a very different profile. So Reddit, where they're very self-policed, you know, will have groups that stay on topic, like, here's how to use my Peloton bike. Twitter has different kinds of affordances, so it allows you to spread news very, very quickly.
For some reason now, I'm thinking that somebody thought that it was a great idea to include emojis for salad and maybe not quite understood exactly how that would end up being used.
Or including images. And nowadays, right, of course, we have memes, which there's words on the images. And the great thing about that is that if a group or a government or whatever outlaws the use of certain words, you just turn it into an image and you can still do it, right? So they continue, like in China, they continued the Me Too movement, even though they weren't supposed to use those words, by simply having a picture of a bowl of rice and a rabbit. So the rabbit has two ears,
right,
and the bowl of rice is me.
Yeah. I can see how that works. Very clever. I guess they have to be clever there.
Yeah.
Speaking of clever, I want to talk about this way of trying bringing them all together to analyze these messages. And in a paper recently, you've introduced what I would suggest is the craziest acronym that I've ever come across, which is the BEND framework. And I say it's crazy because each letter seems to have half a dozen terms that it refers to.
Only four.
It's a very inclusive framework. Can you explain a little bit about it and how to use it?
So the whole BEND framework is designed to look at how one person or one group can influence another person or group. And it has 16 basic maneuvers in it, of which half of them are ways of influencing people by the way you talk, by your message. And the other half are about the way you can influence them by the way you change who is talking to whom. So, for example, one of the maneuvers is to bridge, which is to bridge two groups together. And you can do this, for example, in social media by, or like in Twitter, by sending out messages with at mentions of others. So then the other group says, huh, they're mentioning me. Maybe I better go see what's going on. Okay. And another kind of a maneuver on the narrative side is like excite. And another one is dismay. And those are basically messages you send to get a group, you know, very riled up happy or very riled up sad or angry. And so by using these maneuvers, we can understand how groups can influence each other.
So is it just connecting groups or is it connecting individuals as well?
Both. It can be an individual to a group, an individual to an individual, a group to group.
Is there a way of sort of understanding what would be a positive match between those groups?
A positive match is when they were influencing them, like for some good reason or reaching out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, partly it depends on the purpose of what they're trying to do, right? For example, if one group is trying to recruit another group, you could measure that success of that recruitment by the number of people in the second group that started following or joining the first group. As an example, you could also measure things like the extent to which those maneuvers are used to push groups apart. and polarize them. But again, it depends on what the kind of purpose is of the actor doing it.
Is this helpful in identifying things that need more attention and more analysis?
Well, yes, it's definitely useful and helping. But the way to kind of think about it in context is when a lot of people monitor social media and they want to know how their company's brand's doing, or they want to know how their government's doing, they look for what I call, they look for the magic tweet. They will just simply monitor it and see if they can find a story and say, oh, based on the story, I see this. But that really isn't very helpful, because we really want to know who is trying to change my mind and why. What are they trying to do? And so by using the band maneuvers, we can begin to understand both the why and the what are they trying to do, which is way more than we've done before. And it's way different than saying, I got 15 likes today, which is just, you know, popularity counts.
The why is a very interesting question. Yeah. How much can this tell you about why, and how much help do you need from psychology or other kinds of disciplines in understanding the why for particular tweets?
First off, the band maneuvers themselves, the way they've been built technology-wise, brings into account a lot of findings from psychology and a lot of findings from organization science and so on. And so some of that helps already in there. But like, even once I know that this particular actor is trying to get this group very, very excited and happy, then you have to say, well, how does that relate to other things that actor is doing? Well, if they're also trying to get that group to argue against a particular person, then that gives you the why. You still need humans in the loop to help you interpret how these things are related, to get at, you know, kind of the super why.
This is something that can be adapted with sort of a computer technology. I'm not much good with AI. I wouldn't know my machine learning from my magic bullet. So how does someone like me start to make use of these tools?
Well, when you send email or text messages, right, they do things like they auto-correct you, or they will, you know, give you suggested responses to people. That's AI at work for you. And right now, these technologies, the Ben technology, is so new, but we're trying to get it to the point where it's just built into the systems so that you can then see, oh, it suggests that this person's influencing me to make me happy. That's my daughter sending me a message. Okay, I'm going to leave it, you know, alone. So it's really the people building the platforms and the scientists, you know, and the regulators working together to get this into the technology so it can be AI at work for you.
What kind of things can the Ben framework implemented properly tell me about what's going on in a network?
It can tell you whether or not someone is trying to, you know, encourage you to join a particular group. It could tell you whether or not someone is trying to get you excited or something. They could tell you whether the messages you're getting are basically distortions from the main topic. It can tell you things such as whether or not someone's trying to explain something to you. Now, you probably get that anyway, because they'll use characteristic words like here's why, but it'll give you a feeling. But more importantly, if we can do this like all your media, then it can begin to tell you, you know, whether there are particular actors in there that are disproportionately kind of more than normal trying to influence you. But it can also, now put it in a larger context, you can look at it relative to those around you, your groups, and say, gee, my group has these five people, these five different actors out here, three of which are bots, are trying to make us think that, you know, we should always get up and do Chai Chi in the morning. And then you can decide whether or not you want to follow it or not.
I probably should get up earlier and do more Tai Chi. Besides my COVID exercise routine, how does that feed into our expectations about the management of these platforms? Where is governance in all of this? Because one of the previous discussions around things like YouTube, for example, is just there's too much, there's too many people, there's too many interactions, it's impossible to police. But with the development of better tools, I guess, it creates an ability for governance that can work at the scales that social media works at, I suspect. Where does governments fit in with a framework like this?
Yeah, well, so if you can do this for an individual or group, you could do it at the country level, for example. And you begin to say, what are the messages coming from China or that are coming from Brazil or that are going to Brazil from Russia to look at how one country is trying to influence another? And one of the ways governance comes in is by then coming up with, you know, international regulation on what is acceptable diplomatic behavior and what is actually, you know, in the realm of an information warfare. That's one example. At the corporate level, when you start to see, well, this is how Bayer is influencing this other company over here, you can begin to say, well, now, you know, kind of at the corporate level, what are the fair information laws that we should have for talking about when your advertising and so on is beyond the pale and beyond acceptable?
Influencers and advertising has been sort of a problematic thing for regulators to get their heads around. They've introduced a number of sort of laws that are supposed to, I guess, reflect what was previously decided for other mediums like television, right, and print media for online spaces. But online media doesn't really work in the same way. The relationship between the influencer and the influenced is a little bit different. So I guess there's a potential future for these kinds of analysis in better understanding and better regulating, yeah, those kinds of interactions.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, and you know, I think we're starting to see the legal profession looking at a lot of these issues and companies looking at this issue and saying, you know, the old rules don't really apply in this space. What do we need to think about? Just as we're rethinking what free speech means.
Free speech introduces an interesting question there, and it's about the rights of people to freely associate and interact online. But it's very different from the Roman Forum. There's a different kind of conversation that can happen there, and people stand on different plinths in different kind of ways, and they're not necessarily permitted to speak at a louder volume through strength of their arguments necessarily.
Right. No, but they give a louder volume through the number of bots that echo them, for example. Yeah.
How does this all fit in? We have a world with different kinds of messaging that are repeated in different kinds of ways by both human and non-human actors. How do we deal with a safe space for discourse where we have a mixture of everybody more or less in the world plus an entire population of androids that we haven't previously had to deal with?
Well, I think we have to begin by saying, what do we mean by safe in this environment? Does it mean that every human has equal voice? What does safety mean? You know, I mean, you'll have a different kind of environment if you say safety means that no one can say something that causes a violent reaction that causes someone's death. Then if you say safety means that everyone is allowed to have a voice and that you have to be civil to anyone speaking, you cannot treat them and, you know, use abusive language toward them, so on. Those are different kinds of things. So I think first we have to decide what we mean by safety, and then put in place the different, both legislation, but also the different technology around that.
This is such an area that requires the transdisciplinary approach. I mean, it's really just circling us back to there. Where do we go forward from here, and where are you going forward personally with your own research?
Well, I think that, you know, as a world community, that we need to engage in a lot more discussions about what values do we share and don't share, and what is important within our own communities to enact, you know, with everybody at the table. I don't think we can just leave it up to, you know, legislatures or scientists. I also think that we, as in companies and corporations and churches and schools, need to get much better at doing their own social cybersecurity. They need to monitor the information they're putting out and that others are putting out about them, so to make it more civil and so on. In my own work, I have a big group. So we're currently planning to keep working at issues of disinformation, hate speech, and extremism online, where we're looking at it not just within the local U.S. context, but looking at it also in the Asia-Pacific area and in South America and in Canada, and to see what is common and what's not common, and what are the role of the superpowers in this versus the role of companies in terms of spreading different kinds of information, and how it goes between platforms, which is one of the big challenges now.
That sounds really interesting. So many layers, different countries, different platforms, different cultures. Yeah, wow. I can't wait to see the outcomes of that. And thank you very much for spending some time with us and keep on doing what you're doing.
It was my pleasure, and I will have fun doing it. Thanks.
A sincere thank you again to Dr. Kathleen Carley for sharing with us. And please do find more information and detail in the paper Social Cybersecurity and Emerging Science, which was published in Computational and Mathematical Organization Theory in 2020. It's in the link provided in the show notes for this episode. This has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only made possible by the kind guests sharing their time and their research. If you do have a question or a comment, you can reach me at Cybercrimeology on Twitter, or by old-fashioned email at cybercrimeology@gmail.com.
Hey, Dan, I'm just finishing up here with my new kayaking friends.
Kayaking friends on your computer?
Yeah, I just got America Online.